We have to show that there is another way and that the monster here is capital itself. And we are the ones who are being taken as a meal, basically, for this drive to expand monetized value, which is what capital is. But one thing is sure, that we do have a chance to really transform the society. But if we don't give it our all, the other alternatives are not good. What I care about is, to quoting Walter Benjamin, to pull the emergency brake and stop this cannibalization.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the Dissents podcast. I'm your host, Lukas Ondrejka, and my guest is none other than the leading Marxist feminist philosopher, Nancy Fraser. We are talking about her latest book, Cannibal Capitalism. Nancy, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
In Cannibal Capitalism, you describe capitalism as kind of this monster that consumes our commonwealth, Nancy.
Yes.
It's destroying nature, marginalizing racialized populations, ruining our ability to care for each other, and undermining democracy as well. To start our conversation, why is capitalism at the root of this multiplicity of crises that I think are often looked at separately?
Right.
And secondly, why do you think it's important for a critique of capitalism to integrate all those perspectives, ecological and reproductive perspectives, as well as political and racial perspectives, in kind of one common framework?
Right. Well, let me start with the present. I do think that we are in a moment of a very severe general crisis, meaning not a sectoral crisis, not a crisis that affects only one sector of life, not just a financial crisis, just an ecological crisis, just a economic crisis, just a political crisis. I mean, any one of those would be bad enough. But the truly alarming thing is that all of these arenas are in crisis at once. And the various strands of what is a one big mess converge and exacerbate one another. So that's the diagnosis that I start with in this book, that this is one of these rare moments in the history of modern societies, of capitalist societies, where you have this kind of a general crisis of the entire social order. And what that means to me is that, now just sort of focusing for a moment on the political situation, what that means to me is that the various social movements, political parties, labor movements, associations, all the various forces that are struggling on one front or another to try to solve the problem, each of them is only getting a sort of part of the story. So we have ecological activists battling for a transition to a decarbonized economy to address the crisis of nature, so to speak. On the other hand, we have, you know, labor unions fighting to secure livelihoods in the face of a general deterioration, precarization of work, and so on. We have racial justice movements struggling against police violence, mass incarceration, all kinds of forms of white supremacist violence. Each of these has got their finger on one important part of the story. But because all these things are linked, in my view, it's very, very important that we learn to connect the dots, to see how each of these is a strand of one larger problem, the general crisis, as I just described it. And the way we can see that and figure out how to join forces in a struggle to get to the roots of the problem is by enlarging our view of what capitalism is, because I do believe that the social system itself is perverse and contradictory, and that there are deep structural roots to each of these strands of crisis that can be traced back to one and the same social system. And that system is capitalist society. So in my view, capitalism is not just an economic system. but it's a form of social organization that empowers, and I would even say incentivizes, the investors, the large mega corporations, the very wealthy economic actors, the very powerful economic actors, to essentially devour the conditions that make the capitalist economy possible, nature, state power, and all the public goods and regulatory capacities that states and other political powers supply and that capital needs. Also, the care work, the social reproductive energies and capacities that produce the workers and that are needed to sustain the human ties that make the system possible. All of these things are background conditions for a capitalist economy. Yet they are sort of sitting ducks for these powerful economic actors to prey on, to free ride on, to eat away at without any obligation to replenish what they use up, to repair what they damage. And so over time, there's a long-term tendency for this kind of social system to destabilize its own background conditions of possibility. That's what I think is happening now, but on steroids, because we've been living for the past 40 years under a very predatory, unusually destructive form of capitalism, and that is neoliberal capitalism, financialized capitalism. And 40 years of that have brought the climate crisis to an extreme pitch, the crisis of care or social reproduction to a very acute situation, the racial justice crisis to a fever pitch, really, and the crisis of democracy and indeed of governance more generally also to an extreme pitch. That's the general crisis. From my point of view, it's all rooted in one and the same social system. As I said, in a system that empowers these powerful economic actors to destroy their own conditions of possibility, and what's worse, our own conditions of living.
Yeah, we want to talk more in detail about the different strands where the crisis of capitalism plays out, and also about the fragmented social movements that correspond to these crises, and how these players could orient their struggle towards a common goal without, of course, reducing important differences to connect the dots, as you put it. But first, let's start with the fundamentals and go a bit more in detail what defines capitalism for you today. So why do you describe capitalism as cannibalistic and what you mean by that? And this also entails the question where you differ in your analysis from these kind of more standard Marxist notions of capitalism.
Right. Well, I use the word cannibal and cannibalism and capitalistic because of this built-in structural tendency of the capitalist economy to eat away at and destabilize and in the end destroy its own conditions of possibility. The cover of the book displays a picture of the Ouroboros, the snake that eats its own tail. And that's a fitting metaphor, I think, for this. I mean, right? A cannibal is something that eats its own kind, so to speak. The irony, of course, is that, you know, the accusation of cannibalism was made by European imperialist powers, you know, to describe the Africans they encountered in their conquests and invasions and so on. But the real cannibal is actually capital and a social system that empowers capital to cannibalize its own conditions of possibility. And as I said before, those conditions of possibility are our conditions of living. So in a sense, we are the ones who are being sort of taken as a meal, basically, for this voracious, all-consuming drive to expand monetized value, which is what capital is. So that's why I use the term. And as you suggest, this implies a different, and I would say a larger view of what capitalism is. capitalism is not just an economy, an economic system, but it is the whole larger societal complex in which the economy is situated. The economy does not accumulate wealth out of itself, out of monetized social relations, monetized forms of labor, monetized exchanges, and so on. It also relies on its ability to capture forms of wealth that lie outside the monetized economy, such as care work, such as public goods and political capacities, organizational capacities, such as, let's say, unfree or dependent and semi-free forms of labor, usually the labor of racialized populations that have been subject to conquest and deprived of the means of self-defense. That too is sort of outside the official economy. And yet, along with these other things, supplies essential forms of wealth out of which capital spins its magic of accumulation. So this is a different view from standard Marxian pictures. The official Marxian story is that capital expands its form of wealth through surplus value, through exploiting free workers, wage workers in large-scale for-profit enterprises, workers who are paid only for their living costs while the boss, the capitalist, claims the surplus hours, the extra value that is produced. That's true as far as it goes, but capitalist profit depends on more than surplus value, than on exploitation of free labor in factories. It also depends on these unremunerated inputs or under-remunerated inputs, where business doesn't pay even for the living costs of, or for the reproduction costs of the inputs it takes. I think that Marxists have spent too much focus on surplus value and not enough focus on profit, which includes all those other below cost inputs from nature, from care work, from public powers, and from unfree labor.
Thinking about capitalism in this way, as the system that is not only economically exploiting workers, but also life beyond production, so care work, for instance, nature, racialized communities, and also our political institutions or our ability to determine our future as citizens, this also kind of implies a very different, I guess, expanded view of labor, class, and class struggle, where we focus on an open meaning of class, not just the workers in factories or formal jobs, I guess. So how do you think we have to conceive labor and the global working class today to be up for the task of building a broad coalition against capitalism?
Right. Well, my view is that once you take this expanded view of capitalism that I've just sketched, you also need to take an expanded view of labor and of all the forms of energy and effortful, need-driven activity that contribute in one way or another to the spiraling profits of the capitalist class. You know, so we have to understand labor more broadly. It was always a mistake, in my view, to equate labor and the working class with free European or European descended factory workers who had more or less standard labor contracts and were paid at least for their the cost of living, the cost of their reproduction, their necessary labor time. In addition to that, it has always been the case from the very beginning that capitalist profit depended upon the expropriated labor, not the exploited labor I just described, but labor that was simply seized or stolen in the colonies from the conquered indigenous populations and so on, racialized labor, expropriated labor, unfree or semi-free labor, also the labor of social reproduction, the unpaid or severely underpaid care work, which is an absolutely necessary, indispensable condition of possibility for, well, indeed for any society, but that includes capitalist society. So there we have at least three different forms of labor: exploited labor, expropriated labor, and what we could call domesticated labor or care work, social reproductive labor that is externalized from the normative category of recognized labor in the society. All three of those categories are labor, and the people who perform those various labors should count as part of capitalism's global working class. So this gives you one idea of how to think about forming broader coalitions, how to overcome the separations and dispersions and fragmentations and siloizations of different social struggles today. If we could think in terms of an expanded global working class that encompassed all three of those forms of labor and all the populations who perform them, by the way, in many cases, people perform more than one form of such labor, by the way. So we have all kinds of amalgams and hybrids of the three forms of labor. But analytically, there are three forms, and anyone who performs any one of them or more of them should count as part of the global working class. So that's one proposal for how to think about greater coordination, greater cooperation, and expansion of the social forces that might be needed to mount a powerful struggle, a struggle powerful enough to get to the roots of the system and to transform it. There might be other ideas as well, but that's at least one to start with.
Yeah, I think right now these progressive struggles too often run on like parallel paths, which is not bad at all, but I think it might be worth investing some time into thinking about how to integrate more with each other. And for starters, it would be good when working class organizations such as parties and unions, they have to become more feminist, more anti-racist, and more ecological.
Right.
And I think feminist and anti-racist and ecological movements, they have to become more working class, so to speak, so to connect more with the perspectives of class struggle and social justice.
Right.
And this also addresses kind of the issue of the divide within the left between social and cultural issues. In other writings, Nancy, you address this problem with regard to what you call progressive neoliberalism, where parts of the feminist and anti-racist and ecological movements in the past kind of got co-opted by neoliberalism. So maybe you can elaborate a bit more on how this happened and how we can overcome this problem.
Well, first of all, I want to say that your description of my thinking about this problem is spot on. I do actually believe that existing recognized labor movements in the more conventional sense have to become ecological, feminist, anti-racist, and movements that are currently focused mainly on gender or on race or on ecology have to become more class focused. So now you mentioned this diagnosis of progressive neoliberalism. My view is that neoliberalism is not a sort of a total political Weltanschauung. It's a set of policies that pertain mainly to liberating, you know, the profit-oriented forces from various kinds of controls. And the interesting thing is that it's never able, people who support that policy are never able to win political power with that agenda, because what is that agenda? It's, you know, grow the rich and harm everyone else. In order to win power, they have to link or in some ways even hide or cloak that plutocratic economic agenda, link it up to other more attractive ideas. Neoliberalism in that sense is very, let's say, opportunistic. It can ally with just about anything. I mean, we have Islamist forms of neoliberalism. We have Hindu nationalist forms of neoliberalism. We have straightforward sort of Christian patriarchal forms of neoliberalism. And yes, we have had progressive forms of neoliberalism. And the interesting thing is that in the United States, North America, and in many of the leading countries of Western Europe, it was precisely this alliance of a plutocratic economic agenda with what I would call a sort of meritocratic, progressive, liberal form of recognition politics, equal opportunity for talented women to rise to the top, to crack the glass ceiling, removal of discriminatory barriers so that a sprinkling of non-white faces could appear in high places, an LGBT friendly, you know, proposal for marriage equality and gays and lesbians in the military and so on and so forth. This is what Clintonism was in the, and still is actually, in the Democratic Party in the United States. It's what Blair's New Labour was about in the UK. It's what Schroeder's version of socialist politics in Germany and so on. Many other countries, powerful countries, consolidated neoliberalism in this progressive form. And in so doing, they captured or recuperated or hegemonized important currents of what we thought of as emancipatory social movements. So the mainstream of liberal feminism became very market-friendly and very meritocratic as opposed to social egalitarian. The same was true of important strands of anti-racism, of LGBTQ politics, and so on. And that has had very dire and problematic consequences because not only did it remove important social forces that might have been available for a more left-wing, pro-working class form of feminism, anti-racism, LGBTQ politics, ecological politics, et cetera, et cetera. But even worse, it associated those social movements with this plutocratic policy, alienated important working class forces who were suffering, and turned them against feminism, ecology, LGBTQ, and anti-racist social movements. In other words, this alliance paved the way for Trumpism and for all of the sort of analogs of Trumpism across the world, the various anti-immigrant policies, the parties that scapegoat people of color, or trans people, gays and lesbians, and so on. You know, we have a real political mess on our hands because although before I was talking about, you know, all the various forces that are either emancipatory or potentially emancipatory, we also have these very powerful right-wing authoritarian forces, which have, I hate to say it, they've been the major beneficiaries of the crisis, at least so far. They are the forces that have actually won state power here and there and are strong in parliaments and elsewhere. So this progressive neoliberalism has been a disaster for the left, for anybody with an emancipatory commitment. And the only way to fight it, in my opinion, is to break cleanly with neoliberalism and with the various liberal forms that have supported it, and to develop a real social egalitarian pro-working class movement that is also, as you said at the outset, ecological, feminist, anti-racist, and democratic. That's what we have to do now in order to fight these right-wing forces.
Yeah, and I guess in order to break with neoliberal capitalism and push not only for small reforms, but the larger perspective of emancipation, we have to take a closer look at the different scenes where capitalism is destroying our commonwealth, nature, democracy, care, and the marginalization of racialized communities. I want to start, Nancy, with a closer look at the connection between capitalism and racism.
Yes.
You argue in your book that capitalism is structurally racist and imperialist, expropriating racialized populations across the globe. Could you describe how racism is working within and for capitalism, both historically and today?
Right. Let me start with a book that has had a huge influence on me, and that is W.E.B. Du Bois's book, Black Reconstruction. What Du Bois did in that book, it's a book that was published in 1935, and it's for people who don't know, it's a basically a history of 19th century America that covers the Civil War, the abolition and emancipation of the slaves, the period of Reconstruction that follows the Civil War, in which there are radical forces that are trying to really revolutionize the whole social structure of the South to make legal emancipation a social reality, and then what Du Bois calls the counter-revolution of property that follows when the radical Reconstruction project is unceremoniously shut down. So this is a very important period of American history. And Du Bois analyzes this in an extremely interesting and original way, and one that I think can teach us a lot about how to understand today. What he says is that you don't have Manchester, meaning the iconic textile mills of Northern England, which are, you know, the heart of the first capitalist industrialization. You don't have Manchester without Mississippi, meaning the cheap raw cotton supplied by the enslaved people on the plantations. And the idea, it's like what we were saying before, it's like these are two different faces of capitalist labor, the exploited free white workers in the factories and the enslaved black workers on the plantations. These are separated populations who are divided from one another politically and in terms of the legal status and so on. And yet they are two essential, functionally imbricated pistons of one enormous, powerful engine of profit production. So what this shows me, and Du Bois, by the way, generalizes this and speaks about the global color line. He says that those Mississippi enslaved populations are part of a vast, dark proletariat, a vast mass of dark labor spread across Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, or the South and North America. And this is what the vast majority of workers are. Right, as we said before, the free factory workers are, in a sense, the tip of the iceberg. They're the ones that everyone is focused on. But they don't make profit for you without the cheap inputs or even the free inputs. So that tells you something about the history. And Du Bois, writing in 35, says that's still the case today in 35. And I want to say it's still the case today in 2023. That we could say today, you don't have Cupertino, which is the headquarters of Apple, without Kinshasa, without the Congolese, the brutal mines where lithium for Tesla's battery, Coaltown for iPhones is mined in some cases by literally enslaved Congolese children. So you could also say that you don't have the cheap goods that keep wages low. You don't have Walmart where, you know, the free white working class can buy the stuff they need very cheaply without Dhaka, without Bangladesh, without all those sweatshops where those garments are made and so on. So today, capital still depends hugely on a bifurcated labor system, free largely, but not entirely, white labor, and this dark mass of semi-free or enslaved labor. So there's a global color line still. There's a division between expropriated labor and exploited labor, unfree and free labor, which is, corresponds to the global color line. And capital still depends very much on this racial line.
Yeah, I think right now these diversity campaigns by corporations and governments can't hide the fact that capitalism is thriving on racism. There is no Apple computer that I'm working on right now and talking to you without the expropriation of racialized classes. But this brings me to the question, Nancy, does this have to be the case? Do we have to break with capitalism in order to come closer to a world without racism because capitalism is necessarily racist? Or could there be a capitalism without racism?
Well, I want to give a nuanced answer to this, not a straight yes or no kind of an answer. My view is that capitalism always needs a fund of expropriated labor. The question is, however, does it always need to come from a population that is divided from the other form of labor? Or is it possible that it could, quote unquote, I'm using scare quotes here, that it could equitably distribute exploitation and expropriation across the whole non-propertied global working class? Let me explain why I'm considering that option, because I think that something like that is happening today to a lot of people. In the historic core of capitalism in the United States and parts of Western Europe, we have a situation in which neoliberalization has drastically weakened labor unions. It has relocated manufacturing that was relatively secure jobs, well-paid, unionized. That's gone. We now have the Rust Belt, where people and communities that used to be merely exploited are now in very insecure, precarious work, or if they have paid work at all, where their living costs are not paid out of their wages. They're basically living off of credit card debt and other forms of debt. So they are, I would say, they're no longer simply exploited, but they're expropriated too. And that brings their situation closer to that of the people of color in those same countries who have, quote unquote, graduated to exploited labor. But again, under these very low wage, precarious conditions where they too are living off of debt. Mm-hmm. So these are populations that are, I think they're like hybrids. They're both exploited and expropriated. And I think you could say the same is true for some populations in the post-colonial world who are now working in large scale factories in manufacturing work. And in that sense are exploited. They've become post-colonial citizens. You can't say any longer that they are legally unfree or bound. And yet, because of the various new forms of imperialism, where a lot of wealth is siphoned from those countries through sovereign debt, structurally adjusted by the IMF and the World Bank, much of their labor is going actually to the payment of debt service. So they're exploited and expropriated as well. So I think what I'm suggesting is that we have a more blurred picture. It's not quite the clear global color line that Du Bois described in the 1930s. It's certainly not the global color line of the 1860s, but there's still a color line. We have more like a continuum, and at two ends of the spectrum, you've got those smaller ranks that are now merely exploited, overwhelmingly white European descended at one end. You've got the still huge populations in the favelas and elsewhere that are purely expropriated. And then you've got this more amorphous group in the middle that's both and. So that's why I've been speculating about whether capitalism could, in the end, exploit and expropriate everyone and become, in that sense, quote unquote, non-racist.
Yeah, it might be non-racist, but it's still going to be hell on earth.
First of all, it's not something we should support. We are not for non-racist capitalism in which everybody is equally cannibalized.
Yeah, kind of open borders, but with neoliberalism on steroids.
Exactly. That's not what we should be fighting for. And anyway, I'm not sure that there's even a path to that in any case because of what I was speaking about before. When people who were once, quote unquote, merely exploited see their conditions of life deteriorating, see their status declining, see that they're being dragged down, they don't necessarily say, oh, well, now it's time to join ranks with the people of color who've been facing these conditions for centuries and fight together, black and white, unite and fight. No, what they say is, oh my God, it's their fault. I have to fight at all costs against them. And that's the dynamic where you get the right-wing authoritarian forms of populism with this really, you know, exacerbated forms of white supremacy and other forms of persecutory scapegoating. So, you know, in the absence of a strong counter narrative from the left, they've got a powerful narrative there. And that makes the idea of this horrific scenario we've been, you know, contemplating of non-racial capitalism, it makes it hard to see how you get there, where the path to that is in any case. But given, as I just said, that that's not where we want to go, the most important thing to do is to develop the left counter narrative to show why capitalism as a social system needs a fund of expropriated labor that somebody's got to do, and why you can't, as Du Bois clearly said, you can't liberate exploited labor without also liberating expropriated labor. Marx famously wrote in the same period that Du Bois was writing about the American Civil War, he famously wrote that labor in white skin can't be emancipated while labor in dark skin is still enslaved. That remains true today, even when we're not talking about literal enslavement, which of course still does exist here and there.
In any case, there's good reason to believe that we have to go beyond capitalism to come closer to a world without racism, which doesn't mean, of course, that racism is going to end under socialism or any kind of post-capitalism. That would be naive. But let's move on to the second scene where capitalism is devouring the conditions of its possibility, the devaluation of care work. You describe how capitalism is feeding on the gender-specific hierarchies between production and reproduction.
Yes.
So, Nancy, how is capitalism exploiting care work and gender differences?
Well, let's just start by saying that every society needs to devote a certain amount of its energy, its labor, to producing objects, food, clothing, shelter, et cetera, et cetera. But it also needs to devote quite a bit of its time and energy to sustaining human beings and individuals and communities. It has to gestate, birth, care for, socialize, educate, feed, bathe, you know, the new generations, and it has to sustain and nurture and care for adults and aging people as well. So social reproduction in this sense, that's what feminists mean by social reproduction. The labor that goes into making people as opposed to making things, let alone making profits. Every society has to deal with this social reproduction issue. What is specific about capitalist society is that capitalism is built on a separation, a hiving off of that activity from another kind of activity, which is dedicated to profit making through the production and sale of commodities by, again, free exploited labor in factories for the most part. So this is the only social order that I know of that establishes, institutionalizes a very sharp division and separation between social reproduction on the one hand and for-profit commodity production on the other hand. And that is, as you mentioned, a gendered separation. Capitalism does this by essentially hiving off the factory from the family, so to speak. And you see it even in the architecture of the societies. We quote unquote go out to work, where work means that paid remunerated labor in the factories. And then what goes on inside the home is considered non-work, or has been considered non-work until feminists got into the act and said, no, no, this is work too. So that's the sort of Victorian image of separate spheres. It's always been a bit more complicated than that imagery because there have always been servants in the homes of the ultra rich performing for some kind of pay. Also, there have been slaves doing that work too for no pay. But anyway, there's been a portion of the social reproductive work that has been racialized or commodified in one way or another. And there's also the social democratic phase of capitalism where some of that work was socialized, where social democratic welfare states saw that if you let business have its own way unhindered without any controls, it would simply destroy families. It would, you know, not pay enough to sustain the non-working family members doing care work in the home and children and so on. And so welfare states weighed in for a certain period of time on the side of social reproduction, right? They developed a whole set of public provision, social services and so on, child care, health care, old age pensions, and in some cases, mother's pensions and so on. So that's what neoliberalism has dismantled, or at least retrenched to a considerable degree in many places. And the result has been a renewed crisis of social reproduction. We had one crisis at the beginning of industrialization, where women and children were basically conscripted into mines and factories until the Victorian reformers and others said, no, we got to stop this. We need protective legislation. That didn't really help. Then we got the social democratic welfare state, which, let's say, softened the care crisis in the wealthy countries for majority ethnic working class populations. Didn't do anything, of course, for it kind of offloaded the crisis of care, you could say, to other regions and to populations of color and migrants in those places. Now we have neoliberal capitalism where the gloves are off, so to speak. The controls are greatly weakened, if not destroyed altogether. So again, we've got the huge crisis of care, which the pandemic made very, very visible, I think, in a way that put it more front and center on the radar screen than it had been. So that's our situation now. In one form or another, capitalism always puts pressure on care work. The 30 glorious years of social democracy had a partial solution for some relatively privileged populations. But I want to add that even then, where did the money come from that paid, you know, for those social programs? Ironically, a lot of it came from the automobile industry and allied steel and parts making and so on, meaning an exacerbated carbonization, fossilization of the economy. So even the lesson there is that when capital is constrained in one area to solve one face of the crisis, of its cannibalizing process, at least for one set of populations, it makes it up somewhere else by cannibalizing someone else or something else, as in the case of nature. What that shows me is that you can't deal with the crisis of care or the crisis of racialization or crisis of nature separately. That when you, it's like the little Dutch boy putting the finger in one hole in the dike while other holes pop out. That's kind of the situation. So that's another argument for why we need to think in a holistic way, in an integrated way, about all of these crises.
Yeah, another part of the crisis of capitalism is, of course, the erosion of democracy. Right-wing populism and neo-fascism are a testament to this crisis. Since time is short, I have to refer our listeners to your book, in which they can in length read about the central scene of this fundamental crisis that we are facing right now. Before we discuss how we get out of it, what we do about it, I want to briefly talk about the ecological crisis, climate disaster, and the breakdown of biodiversity.
Right.
When we look at the hegemonic capitalist project to deal with this crisis, we have these proponents of green growth that pose decarbonization through market mechanisms as the solution to this crisis. Nancy, you argue that this is not going to cut it, that capitalism is structurally leading to ecological collapse, and that we have to go beyond it in order to address the crisis. So why is making capitalism greener not going to work?
Well, I mean, I think this is also something that is built in to capitalist society, to any form of capitalism. It didn't start yesterday. You know, we can go back and look at soil depletion crises and the invention of chemical fertilizers, which, you know, cause new problems, runoff and ocean acidification and so on and so forth. We can talk about greenhouse gases. Obviously, the invention of the steam engine turns out to be a world historic event when we began to use coal, not just for on a local scale for heating homes and so on, but now to power huge factory complexes, the shift to refined oil and to natural gas. I mean, this is the pursuit of profit in which the profit makers are always one step ahead of the regulators. As soon as there are some kinds of pollution controls here or there, they find workarounds. They offshore to places that don't have stringent environmental controls. They invent these market schemes creating financialized speculation in carbon offsets, in emission permits, the whole Kyoto Protocol, which is not doing anything to reduce carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions. It is simply now a new profit-making center for Goldman Sachs, which is organizing environmental derivative speculation and all of this kind of stuff. So this suggests that it's a kind of built-in feature of capitalism to try to get nature on the cheap. Capitalist production, well, any production, right, depends on natural inputs. Labor is a metabolic interaction with nature. But everything depends upon whether you replenish what you take and whether you repair what you damage. Capital accumulation is premised on not repairing what you damage, not replacing what you take, on free riding on nature, on access to these free or nearly free or very cheap inputs. And that's the whole history of capitalism. We talk about how productive this system is, what all the great forms of wealth it creates and so on. But I would say capitalism is a deeply destructive system. And when you balance its productivity against its destructivity, it's not clear to me where the balance actually lies. It might fall on the destructive side. I don't know how you would measure that exactly. But, you know, this idea that it's a very productive system, it is arrived at by simply ignoring the costs, the huge costs environmentally. And what this means is that all these so-called green capitalist schemes, all these ideas that we can adapt, we can mitigate, we can use markets to find our way out of all of this. These are all illusions, or worse, they're cynical scams, essentially. And so the conclusion I draw is that there are a lot of potentially emancipatory forms of eco-activism, of climate activism. And I would include some important forms of the degrowth side of the movement, some important forms of the Green New Deal side of the movement, the forces that organize against environmental racism and for environmental justice. These are all aspects of the climate struggle that have great emancipatory potential. To realize that potential, they have to find a way to unite with one another and to win support from a lot of people who have been told that environmentalism is necessarily a job killer and that their livelihoods are going to be at stake if we don't continue to support quote unquote development, which, you know, is a synonym for concrete paving over the whole world. We have to basically show that there is another way and that the monster here is capital itself and that there is no solution that doesn't disable that accumulation mechanism and that doesn't put the whole social organization on a different non-cannibalistic footing, that doesn't free ride, that as we go pays for reproduction costs, repair costs, that doesn't stack them up off to some future that won't come because the whole planet will incinerate before we get to that. That's my idea of a united front of all of the various forms of climate activism, which now at some points disagree with one another, and that also ally with various labor movements that have been a little bit gun shy about environmentalism because they've been fed a pack of lies about it. A lie with anti-racist movements, with feminist movements, with labor movements, movements for livelihood security, for community defense against corporate predation of various kinds. This is all part of one struggle, is what I'm trying to say, because the ecological crisis is intertwined with the social reproductive crisis, intertwined with the racial injustice crisis, and with the crisis of governance and democracy. And unless we can really embrace the view that all of these things are rooted in one and the same social system, which needs to be transformed, then we won't solve any of it.
Yeah, I agree totally. We're going to have to start transforming this economy and our society to liberate ourselves from this monster that's capitalism, to use your metaphor. And it's good, I guess, that we are experiencing a new radicalization, anti-racist struggles, feminist struggles, a renewed unionism and worker struggles, as well as climate activism. And this multiplicity of actors, I think, is a strength. But it seems at times that we need a common narrative, weaving all of them together, of course, without reducing conflicts and differences.
Yes.
When it comes to this common narrative or common perspective, you propose, Nancy, that we come together under the banner of socialism. But at the same time, a lot of progressives are really skeptical if socialism should be our rallying call. And they have one strong argument at their hand. The socialist tradition and the really existing socialisms have, to say the least, mixed relationships towards the ecology, sexist divisions, racism, and the democracy. So why do you think the banner of socialism still holds value for us today? And what would that socialism look like?
Well, let me just, first of all, say that, I mean, I want to distinguish sort of my personal view. Well, it's not just personal, my theoretical view. From my political stance. My political stance is some of us, including me, want to call the alternative socialism. Other people may, for reasons you've just suggested, have some doubts about that term and may want to leave it open, what we call it, or may want to call it, who knows, anarchism or something else. I don't know. And from a political point of view, that's fine. I am not a sectarian. I do not claim that everyone must unite around the banner of socialism. As long as we can agree that we're going to decarbonize the global economy, that we're going to stop capital's free riding on nature, on racialized populations, on care work, on political capacities and public goods, on labor more generally, as long as we agree on that, I really don't care that much about what we call, what we end up with. In fact, I'm even willing to say some people might believe that what we would end up with is a new form of capitalism, a kinder, gentler form of capitalism. My answer is, let's see. Let's see if we can do all these things, get the results we are aiming for, and whether what we have could still in any sense at all be called capitalism. Personally, I strongly doubt it, and I think I have good reasons for doubting it, some of which I've just explained to you, but I'm not hung up on the word from a political point of view. People will find their way either to that word or to some other word. What I care about is to, quoting Walter Benjamin, to pull the emergency brake and stop this cannibalization. Now, I think that socialism does remain a good word. And it's true that in the United States, we did not have social democratic parties and socialist parties and labor parties who consolidated neoliberalization. I think that's a big part of the European issue with the word socialism. It's not just the Soviet. Of course, you know, we also have our anti-communism in the United States. I think it's that you had the experience of parties that called themselves socialist implementing neoliberalization, and we did not. We had the Democratic Party, which those of us on the left, you know, always had some worries about anyway. So that said, what I mean by socialism, for those of us who still think that that's a useful word and want to explore it, I want to say that it's larger than we thought, just as capitalism is larger than an economy. So socialism has to be larger than an alternative economy. It's got to change the relation between the economy and its background conditions. It's got to change the relation between production and reproduction so that one doesn't cannibalize the other. It's got to change the relation between markets and states so that one doesn't cannibalize the other. By the way, I'm not against all markets. That's another issue. I'll get to that in a second. It's got to change the relation between society and nature. And these are things that you correctly note the Soviet Union and the command economy model did not do. They continued to free ride on care work, on nature, and on labor, for sure. So one idea that I have played around with, and I still think is useful, is this idea I mentioned earlier, pay as you go. No free riding on the background conditions of production. Socialism does have to reorganize production and the kind of labor that is deployed in production, but it has to pay for the inputs from nature, from care work, and so on, so that it's not piling up depleted, cannibalized damages. Also, just to get back to this question of markets, now, the little formula that I devised is no markets at the bottom, no markets at the top, maybe some markets in between. What I mean by the bottom are basic needs. I am against the idea of basic income, that you just give people cash and let them buy housing and healthcare and education, stuff like that. Those things should be public goods, not commodities. On this point, you could say that's a social democratic position. I think social democracy was right that those things should not be commodities, but public goods. However, what really distinguishes socialism from social democracy is the top. And what I mean by the top is the societal surplus. In a capitalist society, surplus is privately appropriated by the entrepreneurial class, by the investors, by the large stock market investors, financial institutions, and mega corporations. And they allocate the surplus. They invest it according to their lights in terms of what will bring them even more profit, even more surplus to appropriate. That is a formula for disaster. The profit making cannot be the criterion for surplus allocation. Surplus is our collective property. We produce it, all of us together, in one way or another, by investing our time and energy in care work, by doing it in recognized forms of productive labor, by doing it in sweatshops and places that are not supposed to exist, but do. This is our energy, our effort, and we have to decide how to allocate it, not on the basis of the profit-making class's needs, but on the basis of how we want to see society develop in the future. We may want to decide, by the way, to work less and to produce less surplus, to really focus on simply reproducing a good way of life for everyone without a huge amount of quote-unquote growth. These should be political decisions. No markets at the top. Surplus got to be allocated through some form of democratic decision-making of the whole population to which surplus belongs, so to speak. The middle is the interesting part. The middle is where I think there's space for a lot of experimentation, for co-ops, for worker-owned enterprises, for small businesses, as well as for public enterprises. You know, I don't believe that socialism today means the total suppression of all markets. The crucial thing is no markets at the bottom and no markets at the top. And otherwise, let's see what we can do. As long as we don't let those enterprises at the market level become so big that they are appropriating very decisive quantities of surplus and therefore dictating the course of societal development. So expropriative taxation of profits and so on. That's my idea of socialism. It's very sketchy. This is only the beginning of an idea.
And hopefully the beginning of a larger conversation that is going to happen at many places. And hopefully our listeners are going to be part of it. A conversation about a better future and how we stop the cannibalization of our commonwealth.
Yes.
Speaking of this self-destructive mess that capitalism has put us in, what do you think, Nancy, if we don't manage to strike this alliance between workers, environmental activists, anti-racist and feminist movements, what will the future of capitalism actually look like? I think that the cannibalistic tendencies of capitalism won't necessarily lead to its breakdown. Capitalism thrives on crisis and recomposes itself many times.
Right.
We might see a further erosion of the link between capitalism and democracy that's always been flimsy, I guess. So we might see more autocratic forms of neoliberalism in the future, for example. But what do you actually think what the future of capitalism will look like if we don't manage to bring about that broad coalition to push towards a libertarian, ecological, and democratic socialism, or whatever we call it?
Well, first of all, I agree with you that this is not a theory of a mechanistic theory of automatic breakdown or strict determinism of any kind. Mm. Basically, the future depends on what people do. The thing about a crisis is that it's a time of sort of, let's say, more emphatic freedom of action because people no longer feel so constrained by the dominant narratives, and they're willing to think outside the box, sometimes in ways that are quite emancipatory and potentially good. And in other cases, they gravitate to the worst ideas, for sure. And we see plenty of that today. Mm-hmm. So it's a wild time. And what happens really depends on who succeeds in creating a counter-hegemony. And this could be a capitalist counter-hegemony. In the past, the few crises of this magnitude that we have faced have led to new forms of capitalism. I've already mentioned social democratic capitalism, neoliberal capitalism. And we can't rule out a new form of capitalism, whether it would be a very grim one of the kind you've just described, or I don't know. Some people think that there's some possible form of global Keynesianism that might be possible. You know, this really depends on who can assemble a powerful enough alliance coalition. I would use the Gramscian term, a counter-hegemonic historic bloc, and to try to do something new. It's also possible that that will be a very fascistic scenario. It's possible it will be something, you know, less fascistic. It's also possible that no one succeeds and that, you know, there is a slow sort of unraveling and, you know, warlords and all against all. And some people talked about, you know, a new feudalism and not even a much deglobalized, grim sort of scenario. We can't know. But one thing is sure, that we do have a chance to really transform the society. And if we don't, take it and give it our all. And there's no guarantee of success, that's for sure. But if we don't give it our all, the other alternatives are not good. Some are maybe worse than others, but they're all much worse than the potential one that we have to use this crisis to solve some very fundamental problems of our social system.
Nancy, thank you very much for your precious insights. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Ja, ihr Lieben, das war mein Interview mit Nancy Fraser. Ich hoffe, es hat euch gefallen. Wenn ihr euch für ihre Arbeiten, vor allem ihr Buch Cannibal Capitalism oder zu Deutsch Der Allesfresser, wie der Kapitalismus seine eigenen Grundlagen verschlingt, wenn ihr euch dafür interessiert, dann schaut mal in die Shownotes, da habe ich alles Wissenswerte verlinkt. Und ich werde auch ein Exemplar des Buches verlosen unter allen Fördermitgliedern und das bringt mich dann noch zu einem wichtigen Punkt. Wenn ihr noch nicht dabei seid in der Dissens-Community, dann schließt doch jetzt eine Fördermitgliedschaft ab. Es geht schon ab 2 Euro. Dadurch ermöglicht ihr meine Arbeit und dass ich solche Podcast-Inhalte wie dieses Interview mit Nancy Fraser für alle da draußen kostenlos, werbefrei und unabhängig senden kann. Ja, das wäre wirklich famos, wenn noch mehr Leute von euch Fördermitglieder vom Podcast werden. Und jetzt bleibt mir erstmal nur noch zu sagen, danke, dass ihr dabei wart diese Woche und wir hören uns das nächste Mal.